Fiona Kelly is here with it, says in the papers.
The tragic death of two brothers at their home in County Sligo is a story which dominates the front pages this morning. All papers describe how Shane and Carmel Skeffington arrived home on Sunday evening to find 9-year-old Brandon mortally wounded inside the house, and how they later found the body of their eldest son, 20-year-old Shane, in a shed at the back of the house. Local people describe how the first they knew of the incident was when they heard an air ambulance helicopter in the area. The helicopter took Brandon to Sligo General Hospital, where he was pronounced dead a short time later. The detached family home, which Shane Skeffington built for his family just outside Turbercurry 8 years ago, which was being examined by forensic officers yesterday, is pictured in all of today's papers, as is the detail that Shane Jr. was due in court tomorrow related to a charge of possessing a small amount of cocaine for his personal use. All papers apart from the Irish Times and Irish Examiner lead with this story today. For its lead story, the Times reports that the Public Accounts Committee plans a robust response to former rehab chief Angela Cairns, who filed a High Court action for compensation yesterday, arising from an investigation earlier this year into the rehab group. The Irish Independent and Examiner also carry this story on their front pages this morning. I lost 240k job and spent 10 days in hospital after pack ordeal, is the headline in the Independent. The Examiner, meanwhile, leads today with a story about how the Taoiseach has been called upon to clarify if radical reforms to the medical card system will now take place, following a suggestion by the Minister for Health, Leo Varadkar, that a system based on someone's health instead of their financial needs would not be realistic. The decision by pro-Russian rebels in Ukraine to release both the black box flight recorders from Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 and the bodies of the 298 people killed in the crash is also carried in the front of today's Times. Writing from Donetsk, where a train carrying about 200 of the bodies was headed last night, Daniel McLaughlin describes how shelling in the city has complicated the bid to move the bodies out of eastern Ukraine and hampered efforts by international experts to investigate the disaster. The situation in Gaza also receives extensive coverage in this morning's Times. Ruan McCormack writes from the border in Israel that locals there fully support the invasion of Gaza, while Derek Scally writes from Berlin that the conflict has triggered an explosion of violent hatred of Jews in Germany. And in its lead editorial today, the paper also urges the international community to step up its efforts to secure a swift and enduring ceasefire. Back in the front of the Times, we're told that the redevelopment of Priory Hall will now cost about €27 million, almost three times the original estimate. Elsewhere this morning, most of today's papers report on the hearing in the Commercial Court yesterday, in which Bill Cullen said there is no doubt that his €11.5 million debt to Ulster Bank will be cleared. Mr. Cullen is taking legal action against the sale of the assets of his companies by receivers. But finally, the McGill Summer School is covered by Lise Hand for The Independent and Miriam Lord for The Times, and both quote Stephen Donnelly's line yesterday that if you dropped a TD from the 1940s into the Dáil today, he'd probably say, "What are all these women doing here?" But apart from that, nothing has changed. And both writers also tell us that Garth Brooks got mentioned by a number of speakers yesterday, which would be good news to Dale Farrell, the owner of Nevada Signs in County Offaly, who we're told is doing a roaring trade in bumper stickers which read, "I almost saw Garth at Croke Park." Farrell tells Kirsty Blake Knox in today's Independent that the hurt is gone and people are ready to laugh.
Thank you very much, Fiona. It's 12 minutes past seven. It's the business news.
Rachel, thank you. Profits at video streaming service Netflix more than doubled in the second quarter to $71 million. Revenue from its streaming content service was up nearly 50% to $1.2 billion. The company now has more than 50 million streaming video subscribers. Over 36 million of those are in the US, with the remaining 14 million around the rest of the world. It added 1.69 million users between March and June alone. Shares in Netflix, which are up 22% already this year, rose nearly 2% in after-hours trading in the US to just below $452. The property investment group Hibernia REIT, one of the newest additions to the Irish Stock Exchange, has a management statement out in advance of its AGM today. Since April, it's completed eight acquisitions totaling €267 million, primarily in the central Dublin office sector. That sector now accounts for around 75% of its portfolio, with the remainder being made up of office development land, Dublin residential and industrial assets. Yahoo has acquired the app analytics firm Flurry to help boost its advertising revenue from smartphones. Many social media and internet companies are struggling with the move from desktop to mobile, with the cost per click, that's the price that advertisers pay every time someone clicks on an ad, falling in the main. Flurry helps app developers analyse data about their users and delivers more personalised ads to them. The terms of the deal were not disclosed, but Yahoo is thought to have paid between $200 and $300 million. The board of Time Warner, which was subject to a takeover attempt from Rupert Murdoch last week, has changed its rules to stop shareholders from calling a special meeting to approve a quick takeover. Time Warner previously allowed as few as 15% of its shareholders to call a special meeting. The move was revealed in a regulatory filing yesterday, but it wasn't preempted by any investor taking up a large amount of shares. Last week, it was revealed that Murdoch's 21st Century Fox had launched a bid for Time Warner, valuing it at $85 billion. Finally, on the currency markets, the euro buys at $1.35.2 and 79.2 pence sterling, Gavin.
Thanks, Brian.
Dr. Mads Gilbert is a Norwegian doctor who works in Gaza. I asked him what it had been like overnight.
It's been heavy bombing in Gaza City and I guess also elsewhere in Gaza. The shelling has been continuous, almost continuous, uninterrupted bombing by F-16 and by drones and from the sea shelling. So we heard the explosions and the detonation has shaken the ground and it's not a pleasant place to be.
Will you tell us a little about where you're working and what conditions are like there?
I'm working in the largest hospital in Gaza, which is called Mustafa al-Shifa, or the Shifa Hospital, which is sort of quite a large hospital. It has 600-700 beds, 1,300 employees, and a good 800 doctors, all specialties. This hospital is the trauma center for the 1.7 million people living in Gaza. So it's an important hospital.
And what sort of injuries are you seeing?
Well, you know, we're seeing all sorts of war injuries, a little bit depending on what kind of weaponry the Israelis are using against the Palestinians. The most important and most striking thing is, of course, that the overwhelming majority of the injured are civilians, women and children. And that's quite striking. We haven't seen many, almost none fighters at all in among the injured in Shifa Hospital. So I would say we've had 90% of the injured and kills being civilians. We're seeing amputations, fragment injuries, burns, decapitations, people who are torn totally apart, and of course also more slight injuries like smaller shrapnels. Everyone is scared because the bombing is so fierce and the destruction being so overwhelming that you feel, of course, extremely helpless. And many of those who come in as patients and victims of the bombing have lost, and they have, maybe have lost the whole family. So it's an extremely painful situation to receive those wounded in the emergency room and the disaster reception area in the hospital. Many of the children have injuries that despite that there are children, we have to do a lot of sort of surgical procedures without taking them to the operating room because we simply don't have capacity in the operating room to do everything there. So we have to do it in makeshift dressing rooms and in local anesthesia.
Is the hospital able to cope with the number of people who are now being brought into you?
The amazing thing about the Palestinian people is that they never yield, they never give up, they never sort of wave the white flag in any sense. They find ways to cope, and yes, it is coping, and yes, it is giving the injured and their relatives and the families coming in a very good medical support and also very good psychosocial support, I think. The other night with the horrible bombing of the neighborhood Sashaya, the whole area was finally evacuated, and there was an exodus of Palestinians coming towards Shifa, and they welcomed them all, and they opened the hospital garden for them. And as I left the hospital this early morning in around 4:30, 5 o'clock, the main surgical building was sort of filled by people who are now homeless from the Israeli bombing, because this time the Israelis have so systematically bombed the homes of people, so they have nowhere to stay. And people were sleeping under the open air, open sky, and the stairways and the corridors of the hospital. It's, you know, lots of people. It's a very painful scene. It's not nice at all.
How optimistic are you that some sort of ceasefire can be agreed over the coming hours?
Well, I really hope it will be agreed. I hope somebody with senses can stop this Israeli onslaught of the Palestinian people, really. I mean, up till 10 o'clock last night, 558 Palestinians have been killed, and among them 149 children. And among the 3,504 injured so far, 1,100 are children. So we're talking about 1,400 children being killed or injured and having, nowhere to fly. There is no protection for people in Gaza. There's no shelters. There's no early warning systems like sirens. There's no civil defense. Basically a naked population. And there's nowhere to fly. There's absolutely nowhere to fly, because the same power that is bombing their neighborhoods and homes is keeping the whole Gaza Strip sieged and closed. And it's been like this for 7 years. So it's not like in other, you know, conflict zones where you see civilian losses the first 1 or 2 days, and then the local civilian population flee. They leave. They go to another province or fly to another country. In Gaza, you're stuck. You can't go nowhere. It's completely closed.
And that was Dr. Mads Gilbert, who's a Norwegian doctor working in Gaza's largest hospital. We'll be talking, by the way, to Israel's ambassador to Ireland later on in the programme.
10 minutes past seven, you're listening to Morning Ireland. Operation Protective Edge, Israel's offensive into Gaza, is entering its third week this morning. Rockets are still being fired by Israel into Gaza and by Hamas into Israel. Nearly 600 Palestinians, mostly civilians, are dead. 29 Israelis, mostly soldiers, are dead. Shortly, we'll hear from a doctor working in a hospital in Gaza, and later we'll talk to Israel's ambassador to Ireland. But first, let's go to Gaza City. David Blair is chief correspondent with the Daily Telegraph. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Where are you and what's happening where you are this morning?
I'm in the centre of Gaza City, and there was another intense bombardment overnight. There was a shelling from a warship off the coast in the early hours of the morning, and then a couple of hours ago there was what sounded like an airstrike, a very loud explosion indeed. Now, this is all completely normal. The bombardment here is pretty much continuous. At almost any time of the day or night, some area of Gaza is being bombarded. So I'm afraid there was nothing remotely unusual about last night.
What was unusual about yesterday was the hitting of a hospital. We'll be hearing from a doctor at a hospital in Gaza shortly. Remind us, why did the Israelis target a hospital?
It's not entirely clear what happened. It appears that a tank shell, possibly more than one tank shell, hit a hospital in the central Gaza Strip. And we know that the administration building, the intensive care unit, and the surgery department of the hospital were all very badly damaged, and that four people, possibly a few more, were killed, and several dozen were injured. Now, it's the first time so far in this conflict that a hospital that has actually been occupied has been hit. There was another hospital that was completely destroyed, but only after it was evacuated of all its patients. We're not quite clear what happened in that incident yet, but there's no question that the people were killed inside a building that should, under the laws of war, be protected.
You've been visiting UN schools, which are full of refugees. Tell us about them.
The displacement of Palestinians is extraordinary. As of yesterday, about 90,000 people had left their homes, and most of them were sheltering inside UN properties. So a school I went to, run by the UN, now has 1,700 people living inside it. Every classroom has become a dormitory. A typical classroom now has 50 or 60 people sleeping inside it. And the numbers who are facing this situation grow every day. As recently as last Friday, the UN estimate was that 30,000 people were displaced. Now it's 90, so it's trebled in the space of just a few days. And the reason why that's happening is that the Israeli troops and tanks are pressing further into Gaza every day. And as they advance, more and more people flee to get out of the way. And they're actually given warnings to flee. They get voicemail messages from the Israeli armed forces telling them to leave, and leaflets get scattered from the skies delivering the same message. And it's very clear now that if you stay, if you ignore those warnings, then you do so at very great risk.
Are those schools, are those UN refuges, are they safe?
Good question. So far, yes. I don't know of any instance of anyone being hurt or killed inside a UN property. However, I understand that 60 UN properties have been damaged in some way since this offensive began 15 days ago, although it's not clear whether any of them were deliberately targeted.
David, where else can people go when those schools, when those UN buildings are full?
There are no options, really. You have to remember that Gaza's borders are closed. Both Israel and Egypt won't allow anyone to leave except a few desperately urgent medical cases. And so the world of the Palestinians of Gaza is confined to this little territory, which is 25 miles long and 7 miles wide. So they really have no option but to flee to the nearest UN property and hope that it turns out to be safe and hope that it's not too absurdly crowded like the school was that I visited yesterday and hope that the flow of food and water and basic essentials is allowed to continue.
Do you get any sense of how long this is going to go on for? Is a ceasefire likely anytime soon?
Certainly there's now a diplomatic effort to secure a ceasefire, and America is leading that diplomatic effort, which wasn't the case last week. So that's a change. So that suggests that at long last the international community is getting its act together, and Israel and Hamas will both come under serious pressure now to reach a ceasefire agreement. Having said that, the intensity of the fighting is pretty extraordinary. On Sunday, Israel lost 13 soldiers, which was their heaviest loss in a single day for 12 years. Then on Monday, they lost another 7 soldiers. Meanwhile, Hamas are still firing, give or take, 100 rockets a day at Israel. And the bombardment, as we talked about earlier, is pretty much continuous of Gaza itself. So given the intensity of the conflict, it's very hard to see how it can just be ended overnight, as it were. So my suspicion is that we've got probably a few more days and possibly a week or more.
David, thank you. That's David Blair, Chief Foreign Correspondent with the Daily Telegraph, speaking to us from Gaza City.
Darren joins us with the sport. Morning to you, Darren.
Good morning to you, Rachel. We'll start with some very good news this morning. The Republic of Ireland under-19 women's team have booked a place in the semi-finals of the European Championships. They beat Sweden last night by 2-1. Savannah McCarthy and Megan Connolly scored the goals in Norway to seal their passage to the last four. Now, Sweden won this tournament 2 years ago. The Irish faced the Netherlands for a place in the finals on Thursday, and they're hoping to create some history. Let's hear from their manager, Dave Connell.
We know when the chips are down, our girls will deliver. We came over here, we knew we were the 8th seed. We came in as the best runner-up in all the groups in the elite phase, and we used that to our advantage. We worked very, very hard over the last couple of weeks. And obviously we had difficult moments to try and get the girls in because a lot of them were doing the leaving cert. Really, really fantastic young girls, worked very, very, very hard, and there's no substitute for hard work. They've really, really been amazing. We'll be going in against the Dutch with who we know are a good side, who obviously have a huge history, again, in women's football, have a lot more facilities, have a lot more programmes. Players are playing with top clubs in around Holland and in Europe. Their centre-forward just signed for Bayern Munich. So we'll relish that. We'll relish that, and we'll certainly take them on. And it won't be easy for them. But, yeah, we're looking forward to it.
And we'll have more from the Irish camp. We'll be going live to Norway on our next sports bulletin at 8:30. And just to point out, Ireland have already beaten some of the top nations in the world at this level already. Spain, England and Sweden last night. So we'll be hearing it from the camp a little later. Shamrock Rovers beat Cork City 2-0 in the quarterfinals of the EA Sports Cup. Ronan Finn and Kieran Kilduff score the goals. Both teams finish with 10 men following the red cards for Gary Buckley and Gary McCabe. Celtic are back in Champions League action this evening. They take a 1-0 lead into their second leg of their qualifier against KR Reykjavik. The match will be played at Murrayfield. Irish striker Anthony Stokes will miss the encounter with a muscle injury. The game gets underway at 7:45, and remember, the winner will play either St. Pat's or Legia Warsaw in the next round. Now, in Gaelic games, very interesting development in Wexford overnight. The Wexford County Board not happy at all with their allocation of tickets for the All-Ireland Hurling Quarter-Final doubleheader at Semple Stadium at the weekend. Now, they held an emergency meeting last night. They've decided to suspend ticket sales for the game against Limerick until tomorrow. They're unhappy. They've received just 2,000 stand tickets for the clash, and they say they have a request of 4,000 to 5,000 stand tickets alone for the game.
Because they have been turning out in great numbers, in fairness to them. And when you think of the sort of form they've had over recent years, I mean, it's a brilliant year for
Wexford.
Well,
look, they've had a decade in the doldrums, Rachel, and they've got a real run of momentum now. We saw Nolan Park at the weekend, amazing colour, and again at Wexford Park when they played Clare in that replay. So they
don't mention it.
Are Wexford the new Clare then, are they?
Stop it now.
We'll have to wait and see. Might be a bit early
be
for that.
Be tormented
but,
here.
But what is interesting is officials are expected to make a formal request to have the games moved to Croke Park today. I can't really see that happening at this stage. It would be a nice thought, because if we look at the other teams in the quarterfinals as well, Limerick, huge support, Tipperary and Dublin, you could see 50,000 in Croke Park if it was held there. Look, it's much too late in the day, in my opinion, for that to be moved to Croke Park. And Semple Stadium is the kind of traditional home at this stage for those All-Ireland quarterfinals. And also, Gart Brooks was meant to be there this weekend. So I think that probably influenced
was
the decision as well.
Was there not something else due to happen in Croke Park this weekend?
So look, at this stage, I can see that request falling on deaf ears. But look, you can understand the frustration for Wexford supporters. Just 2,000 stand tickets for that game. Limerick play Waterford in the Electric Ireland Munster Hurling Final replay tonight. The game takes place at Semple Stadium at 7:30. Stage 16 of the Tour de France takes place today in the Pyrenees. And today's stage, 240 kilometres long, should be a tough one. Italy's Vincenzo Nibali continues to hold a lead of 4 minutes and 37 seconds. Nicholas Roach, 48th, over 90 minutes behind the leader. In tennis, the FBD Men's Irish Open gets underway this morning at Fitzwilliam. The tournament's top seed is Sam Barry. He's from Limerick and he's among those in action.
I'm seeded one, but obviously it doesn't have a huge bearing on the outcome of the tournament. I'd like to think I'm in good form. I've won a couple of tournaments, but I put a lot into my tennis and expect a lot for myself as well. So hopefully this week will be another good opportunity to try and improve and make the most of a good opportunity.
And play gets underway at Fitzwilliam this morning at 10 a.m. Finally, there's racing in Ballinrobe this evening, and the action there gets underway at 6:15.
Darren, thank you. Do you have home insurance? When was the last time you checked or changed your policy? Because according to the National Consumer Agency, if you do, you could make big savings. Fergal O'Leary is here. He's the agency's Director of Consumer Contacts and Insights. Fergal, thanks for coming in to us. €264, you're saying, is the average saving to be made simply by shopping around. Tell us more.
So what we've done with this survey, as we normally do around this time of year, is we've compared insurance profiles right across the country, average profiles. There's nothing strange or unusual in any of them. And what we have found, again, in this survey is that there are very large differences in the quotes that we've received. I suppose what we're pointing out as well with this survey is that it's not just the prices that are different, it's the excesses, it's the benefits, and it's the key terms and conditions. So while there is rightly a lot of focus on price, what we are advising people to do is to look at price, but also to look at what they're getting for that price.
You take a couple of examples here. You're looking at a three-bedroom bungalow, for example, in Middletown in County Cork, and there's quite a range in terms of the cost of home insurance here.
There is. It ranges from €279 to €700 for this particular property in Middletown in County Cork. And what you can see with this profile as well is that the excesses, which is the amount any consumer would have to pay out of their own pocket first in the event of a claim, range from €350 to €500. And what we see as well is that the cheapest quote in this instance may not necessarily have the lowest excess. So it would be very nice and handy for us to be able to say that there's a particular insurance company who does seem to be the cheapest, but that doesn't seem to be the case. And what we do also know from comparing these surveys year on year is that the market changes quite considerably. So a consumer who might have gotten a good deal on their home insurance last year and who believes that they are with a provider who is offering them value, if they look in the market again, there's a very good chance that they could save money because the market changes and things do move around.
You found in your survey, though, unsurprisingly, that people aren't shopping around. Why?
Yeah, I suppose what the key issue here is that people feel the hassle outweighs the benefit. And I suppose what we have to keep in mind as well is that consumers don't have to just switch home insurance. They have to look at their health insurance, their motor insurance, their gas, their electricity bills. And I think people, once they start to think about all the products and services they have, it maybe become a little bit too daunting. So in our view, in the National Consumer Agency, what we're trying to do with the information on our website, consumerhelp.ie, is make it as easy as possible for people. Because if you get rid of as many barriers as possible, people can then realise the benefits quite quickly.
It's your job to compare and you have the expertise to do so. But for most people at home, the idea of reading terms and conditions and comparing them is a task that would make most people want to tear their hair out.
You're absolutely right. And I suppose what we're trying to do is to help people. We have a contents checklist and we have a home insurance shopping around checklist on our website, which does make it easier. And what we can say categorically is that if people do take a little bit of time, they can stand to save significant amounts of monies. And these days, if you know what you're comparing, and that's the help we're providing, if you match that to the fact that you can get a couple of quotes, probably in 15 minutes, either over the phone, online, or through a broker, I think the actual barriers are less than people may think they are. And importantly, what our survey also showed is that 83% of people who did switch found the process easy. So there's a positive message for people who do take a little bit of time.
A lot of people who are changing their policies or updating their policies at the moment, there's been a huge increase in the number of people who've put alarms in their homes in recent years because of at least a perceived increase in the number of burglaries. Does that make a difference?
It does make a difference. And locks, you know, modern deadbolt locks on windows and doors, they make a difference as well. Having smoke alarms makes a difference. So again, if you look at the things that are important to insurance companies, some of these can be installed relatively cheaply. Other ones, obviously, like an alarm or even a monitored alarm, will probably give you a greater discount. That's where you need to make the calculation between the savings that you'll get in your home insurance, the security that you get on your home, but also, I suppose, the cost of installing these things.
You're advising people as well to check or recheck the value of their house. Why?
It's very important that people aren't underinsured, because I think there's a perception there that maybe if you're 10 or 15% underinsured, and I'll give an example, say, for example, on your contents insurance, you are you have cover of 25,000, but in reality, the value of the contents in your home is 50,000. In the event of a catastrophe and you lose everything, you won't get 25%, or you won't get 25,000 because you're 50% underinsured. You'll actually only get 50% of that 25,000. So the losses there can be quite substantial, and that's contents. But if you look at the same thing for rebuild, you could leave yourself with a very high bill if you're not adequately insured, because what insurance companies do is they apply this average clause rather than just giving you the monetary amount. So what we're advising people to do, take a little bit of time, first of all, to make sure that the contents in their home are properly covered, important things like jewellery, iPhones, etc.
Okay.
And then when it comes to your home itself, the rebuild costs, you can check very quickly on the Society of Chartered Surveyors website. They have a rebuild cost calculator. That's a useful tool, because You neither want to be underinsured, you could substantially lose a lot, or if you're overinsured, you won't really gain anything extra and you're only paying more.
Fergal O'Leary from the National Consumer Agency, thank you. Gaza and the downing of a Malaysian airliner will be top of the agenda in Brussels today, where EU foreign ministers are meeting. Our Europe correspondent Paul Cunningham is there. Paul, are they going to impose sanctions on Russia?
I think that is probably unlikely. You might remember that EU leaders met here in Brussels last week, and they felt that Russia had not done enough. The President Putin had not honoured his side of the bargain by exerting pressure in eastern Ukraine. So what they've decided to do is to undertake an examination of how sanctions can be expanded, and that report is due to be completed at the end of this month. So it would not be possible for the foreign ministers to effectively get in the way of that. Yet at the same time, they are possibly going to look at intensifying some of the sanctions which are already in place. So it'll be more nuanced. What we won't have is a big bang coming out of today's meeting.
Is the reality that the EU can't afford to come down too hard on one of its biggest trading partners?
Well, trade is certainly an issue. The other question is energy. So much of European gas comes from Russia, and if there were to be severe sanctions and Russia was to retaliate, it could have a significant impact on the European economy. But I think things are going to be ratcheted up. It was a thing which was put to the German Chancellor Angela Merkel about whether she was worried about consequences as a result of strengthening sanctions, and she said no. So it would appear that Europe is prepared to pay the price.
It's Charlie Flanagan's first foreign affairs meeting, Paul. Is he going to simply call for more diplomacy, or, given that an Irish citizen was among those killed in the crash, is he going to go further?
Well, I think, as he said, this is the first council that Charles Flanagan is going to visit. When he was talking about Northern Ireland in recent days, he said he was in listening mode as he made contact with various different leaders in Northern Ireland. He doesn't have that chance today. He's walking straight into a huge meeting where Ireland has strong positions when it comes to Gaza, and also has obviously is part of the tragedy, given that a Dublin woman died in MH17. On Gaza, I think what Ireland will be seeking for is that we just don't effectively see in the conclusions a state of play of what's happening, but it's more forward-looking than that, and that EU would take a strong position on a two-state solution. In other words, saying that once the fighting ends, whenever that might be, unless you have a negotiated settlement of the Palestinian question, we're going to be in another similar disastrous phase in a few years' time. When it comes to Ukraine, the negotiators met at 7 o'clock this morning and are still effectively trying to beef up some of the conclusions, which once again will be putting pressure on Russia for failing to do all it meant to do. I think there'll be huge relief that there has been progress on getting the bodies out of southeast Ukraine. I think there'd be great relief that there has been something to do with the flight recorders being handed over to Malaysia. But more than that, they'll want a toughening up of the language on it, and that's where effectively Charlie Flanagan's going to have to get in and roll up his sleeves.
7:30, I'll get to news headlines shortly. Paul, what will or what can the EU do about Gaza?
When it comes to Gaza, it's obviously been a difficult position, not just because we don't have that much influence. While there's huge amounts of humanitarian aid going to Gaza, it's usually been the United States which has led the charge when it comes to securing some form of ceasefire when there have been previous outbreaks of violence. Obviously, all eyes have been on the United States Secretary of State, John Kerry, and what he's been doing. But there is a desire that the EU is going to be a leader on the issue and trying to take a more forward-looking stance. So what they come up with, I don't know, but certainly that's the desire, and particularly on the Irish side, that we try and sort of get stuck into this and not leave it to the United States.
Paul Cunningham in Brussels, thank you.
Brian Finn is here with this morning's business headlines.
Rachel, thank you. The property investment group Hibernia REIT has its AGM today. In advance of the meeting, the firm said in a management statement that it's looking at raising additional debt on its existing acquisitions. Since it launched in December last year, Hibernia REIT has concluded deals to the value of €336 million. Yesterday, the Financial Times published an editorial calling on the European Central Bank to proceed with some form of quantitative easing, effectively increasing the flow of money in the Eurozone to get it out of its low inflation trap. It came as the ECB introduced a number of changes to make its operations more transparent. Lorcan Roach-Kelly of Agenda Research joins us now. Lorcan, looking at the changes to be introduced first, they're going to publish records of the meeting. Will this be as transparent as they do in the US when they publish fairly detailed meetings or minutes every month?
Good morning. No, I don't think it will be as transparent as the US or even as the Transparency Bank of England, who also publish minutes. I think the problem the ECB will have with publishing minutes is that they don't want to attach names to actions, because the ECB is a central bank made up of national central bank heads. And if national central bank heads like Patrick Onan or Friedman or any of the central bank heads have their name attached to a vote, there will be, I suppose, a perception of national pressure to act in a national interest rather than a European interest. So I think from the ECB, once we see minutes, we will get indications of how a vote went rather than who voted what way in that vote.
They're also moving to 6 weekly meetings as opposed to monthly meetings. What's the rationale behind this move?
Well, when Draghi announced this there at the last meeting, he says there's an expectation whenever the ECB meets that they will do something. So if they have 12 meetings a year, there is 12 times there's expectations they will, the ECB is going to make a change to policy. So by reducing the number of meetings, he reduces the expectations, or at least the number of expectations of changes to policy, is his logic, which makes sense, I suppose.
Looking at the quantitative easing aspect, the Americans are nearing the end of their program. Why have the ECB resisted it, and do you think they'll move in that direction?
I think the ECB have resisted it because the ECB's mandate is that they look after inflation, and they're not allowed to do what's called monetary easing, which basically means buying government debt in order to make it easy for a government to issue that debt. And in the United States, there's no such controls on the Federal Reserve, so they can buy that debt quite easily. The only thing that allows the ECB to buy assets in the market is if inflation expectations are low and remain low. And what we're seeing right now is that exact scenario, where inflation has fallen to, it's been under 1% inflation in Europe since September of last year, which for the central bank is a target of nearly 2%, that means the ECB is failing on its targets. And what we're seeing now at the moment is inflation expectations are also falling, which means inflation is low now, but people expect inflation to be low in the future. And that's the trigger for the ECB to be allowed to do asset purchases, because they're allowed to do them in order to change inflation for the future. They don't feel comfortable doing it in order to increase asset prices in the future. And that's why what I mean is that they're not going to buy government debt in order to make it easy for that government to issue debt in the future. But right now in the euro area, financial asset prices are doing okay. Government debt have no problem issuing debt, and stock market prices are doing okay as well. So I think in that scenario that we're looking at the moment, the ECB probably will actually do quantitative easing, but only to tackle inflation expectations.
And just briefly, do you think it'll work?
It won't not work. I think it's very hard to look at what the Bank of England did and what the Federal Reserve did and say that was a failure. Like, at the moment, the European Central Bank is the one to say, okay, this one hasn't done QE. Where is growth worst in the world at the moment? In the euro area, where the central bank hasn't done QE.
Okay. Lorcan, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us this morning. That's Lorcan Roach-Kelly of Agenda Research. Just finally on the currencies, the euro is at around $1.35 and 79 pence sterling.
Well, not that long ago, it was the titan of main streets and shopping centres everywhere, with every year bringing record sales figures and eye-watering profits. But yesterday, the chief executive of Tesco was sacked, and the supermarket warned that yet again it would miss profit forecasts. Philip Clark won't leave empty-handed. According to one estimate, he's likely to walk away with as much as £10 million in cash and shares. With us is Damien O'Reilly, who's a lecturer in retail management at the Dublin Institute of Technology. Good morning.
Good morning, Rachel.
Is it fair to say that his departure didn't come as a surprise?
At the end of the day, no, it didn't come as a surprise. There'd been several profit warnings since 2011, since he took over from Sir Terry Leahy. And I think this one was just one too many for the markets. I think the writing was on the wall maybe some months ago when Lewis was already touted as being a successor to Lewis, as being a successor to Clark, and that he even said himself recently that he thought that he wouldn't have very many years left there at Tesco's himself. I think also bringing in a new finance director, Alan Stewart, there recently, very recently, I think that was done with the departure of Clark in mind as well.
How has Tesco been faring in this country?
In this country, Tesco has lost market share, similar to in the UK. They're down to around 26.5% now, down from 28% that they had in the market. They're still well ahead of most of the other companies. Now, Super Value have caught up, having integrated the acquisition of Superquin. So they're at around 25% now. And Dunnes are at around 24%, 23%. But they seem to be losing market share here.
It's in Britain, though, that Tesco has the big, big problem. What's gone wrong?
Well, I think what happened when Clark came in is that there was that huge legacy there from Sir Terry Leahy. Sir Terry built a company from, in the 14 years that he was there, from a profit of $750 million in 1977 up to $3.4 billion in 2010 when he was leaving.
So it expanded and expanded and expanded again.
Became the third biggest retailer in the world, had moved into the US. I think when Clark came in, he came in at an inopportune time, just in the middle of the recession, kind of in 2010 when Sir Terry said he was leaving, and the profit warnings came when he came in at 2011. I think what he did was he didn't build on the legacy of Sir Terry. He instituted a big price drop, which was a reaction to the discounters Lidl and Aldi. So rather than dominating as the biggest player in the market, he was reacting to what the smaller players were doing, rather than having a nuclear option and trying to attack them on low prices. So at the moment, they're opening more smaller stores, because that's the way the consumer is moving, is that we don't want to do big shops anymore. So we're shopping in the smaller stores. So Aldi and Lidl are gaining momentum all the time in the UK. Also, the Aldi and Lidl growth in the UK, they're at around 8.5%, which is, when you consider it around 15% here in the market, there's a lot of growth in the UK. So I think what he's got to do is to shore this up, compete directly with Aldi and Lidl on one level, but let's hope that the fallout for Tesco's will be within Asda and Morrison's, probably in the UK.
As you mention Aldi and Lidl, I was reading earlier about the founder of Aldi. He's died over the past few days, a man who seems to have had an extraordinary life.
That's right, Carl Albrecht. And they started, himself and his brother Theo, started the company after the war, when they found that the mother's shop was still, hadn't been bombed in Essen. And basically they started from there, grew the business, and basically said, we're keeping small margins, we're keeping tin food initially so that nothing will go off. And that they worked on very, very small margins, had a very, very small number of products, and they still have a very small number of products. When you go into an Aldi or a Lidl, is that there are around 1,000 to 1,200 products. So they maintain that, maintain low margins. And what they've done and done extremely well here and in the UK is that they've taken the model, but they've made it very locally mm-hmm. based. So they've looked at the culture of the company, the countries. So for example, you get here Aldi and Lidl suggesting that they're buying a lot of Irish produce. When you go to the UK, they buy a lot of UK products. They have products that suit the tastes of the culture in the UK and in Ireland. So they've adapted to the culture, maybe, and that's something that Tesco probably didn't do in the US. Also with Carl, they were very, very private individuals. His brother Theo was kidnapped and in the early 70s for 17 days and actually they paid a ransom of $3 million, and he actually went to the courts to see if he could write it off as a tax expense.
All right. Well, listen, many thanks for joining us this morning. That was Damien O'Reilly of DIT.
Pat Clark is at Metair. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning. Hello, good morning everyone from Metairn. Well, in general terms, the warm and very humid weather will persist until Saturday. This will give us some pleasant spells of hazy sunshine at times. But with the high humidities, there will be a lot of cloud about as well, and also some mist and sea fog. There'll be some occasional rain or showers at times, some of it thundery. Winds will be light variable, locally moderate and any sea breezes. Looking at this in more detail, today is going to be another warm and humid day. In fact, the temperatures last night didn't fall below 17 or 18 degrees in many parts of the country. There'll be some hazy sunshine, probably best in eastern areas, but a lot of cloud and mist about, with hill and coastal fog. Some drizzle too, and some showery rain developing, with the western half of the country most at risk of this. And in any rain, it could turn heavy with some thundery bursts locally this afternoon and early this evening. Highest temperatures today, 19 to 24 degrees. Close and humid overnight. There'll be further patches of drizzle, fog and mist in places. And in Atlantic coastal areas, there could be some thundery bursts of rain as well. Lowest temperatures in the mid-teens, possibly higher. Warm and humid again tomorrow, Wednesday, with the same mixture of cloudy, misty periods and spells of hazy sunshine. After early rain in western areas dies out, most places will have a lot of dry weather then, but some thundery showers are expected in the afternoon and evening, with the western half of the country most at risk. Temperatures tomorrow in the low to mid-20s, and there'll be light variable breezes. Little change in the humid conditions for Wednesday night, and warm and close for Thursday and Friday too. The same mixture of cloudy, misty periods and occasional spells of sunshine. Very warm in that sunshine, but still some showers likely to break out with the high humidity and high temperatures. A few thundery in nature, but perhaps some local spot flooding. And once again, temperatures in the low to mid-20s. There is some uncertainty regarding the developments for next weekend, but at this stage it looks as if it'll be warm and close to start with on Saturday, some hazy sunshine for a time, but a spell of rain is likely to move across the country later in the day, and once this front passes through to the east, it looks like introducing much fresher conditions for Sunday, with moderate westerly winds and temperatures back to normal. That's how the weather looks this morning. A very good morning.